Welcome to another episode of Code for Thought. In 2023, we saw big announcements of progress being made in machine learning and artificial intelligence. I mean, just think of ChatGPT-4 at the beginning of the year. The press has gone into overdrive, and we've seen plenty of warnings how AI and machine learning will impact our lives and the world around us. If the hype is justified, however, only for you to decide. But for sure, machine learning has made significant advances. It has been deployed in a wide range of fields and not just for the purpose of marketing and bringing more personalized ads to you. In fact, machine learning is being used in a number of research and science projects. In some of them, like particle physics, it's been used for some time actually. Which brings me to my guests for this episode, Marie Pirot and Peter Steinbach. Both work for the Helmholtz Research Association in Germany, Marie in Munich, and Peter at the center in Dresden. Helmholtz is the biggest of the national research centers in Germany, and Peter and Marie work in one of the newer areas of Helmholtz, that is Helmholtz AI. And here they talk about the work they do and what the common challenges are. But first, let Marie and Peter introduce themselves. Let's start with Marie from the Helmholtz Center in Munich.
Personally, I graduated as a theoretical and computational physicist, and I then moved to data science and AI during different postdocs. I work in the industry as a senior research engineer for digital healthcare before taking on this position at Helmholtz Munich.
Hi, I'm Peter. I'm a trained particle physicist, an experimental one. And then I switched gears, became a consultant support, if you want, for HPC at a life science institute here in Dresden. And now I'm heading a team of Helmholtz AI consultants, similar as Marie, at the Helmholtz Zentrum Dresden-Rossendorf. And our expertise and focus is mostly on physics-related topics, all using, exploiting, supported by machine learning.
It's quite interesting that there are now obviously different centers in Germany about machine learning and artificial intelligence. So Marie, you sit in Munich and Peter sits in Dresden. Are there any others in Germany that deal with the subject and where would they be?
I think there is AI research in all the Helmholtz centers, but our platform Helmholtz AI is implemented into 6 different research centers. We have Dresden, Munich, KIT, Jülich, Hamburg, and DLR, which is in Munich and Cologne.
It's spread basically all over the country then. Yes. So what exactly is then the Helmholtz AI platform?
The Helmholtz Association as a whole has 18 centers across Germany. It's 45,000 people that work at Helmholtz Center, so it's a lot of people. And half of those roughly are scientific staff. And this is our customer base, if you will. Helmholtz AI, if you look at it from a bird's eye view, it looks like a canonical research network. So we basically have young investigator groups. There is funding available. People can also apply for what we call Helmholtz AI projects. There is an annual call. And that's all pretty standard, if you will. It's really a great chance that the Helmholtz Association grasped in 2019 to start this, focusing on AI. An evolutionary step was actually taken pretty early on when this was planned for, namely that not only a research domain was actually catered to by the measures I just outlined, but also in a different way, namely that consultants have been instantiated. And this is our task, Marie and my teams. And what we do is we offer expertise as an infrastructure, or as we sometimes also say, collaboration as a service. So it's our mandate to support scientists with machine learning. And that's effectively what we do, which I consider quite a milestone, if you will, in how science is organized, because such instruments where teams and people are really put into place to help other people is not so custom in these topics such as data science and machine learning, I would say.
No, because the standard model is that you have a research project, you scramble together some temporary positions, you get your postdocs, and then you get your doctoral students, and then you go away and do your stuff. Marie, you already alluded to the areas that you're looking at. Is that life sciences? Did I understand this correct? Is that where your expertise is in terms of machine learning and artificial intelligence?
Yes, exactly. So each team has a different focus or different research field. And in my case, it's health and life sciences.
Machine learning and artificial intelligence and life sciences. What kind of projects are we actually talking about? Where does machine learning come in?
I can speak only for my field, but we roughly get one third of projects which revolve around imaging. So either medical imaging or actually a lot of microscopy data that is coming from the different experimental group. One third of the projects that we get revolve around so-called omics data. So these very large data sets that are generated for the modern techniques for gene sequencing, gene expression and proteomics and so on. And then the other third is a bit more classical machine learning. We could say clinical data, smaller data sets, could be a little bit of sometimes time series, echocardiograms, things like that.
Is that for research only or does it actually go into clinical practice as well at some stage?
We do, as Peter explained, really internal consulting for Helmholtz researchers. So it's really primarily focused on research and the main goal of this project is often to be published. But of course, depending on the projects, some are closer to potential clinical applications than others. So sometimes it's really derive new insights in the data and sometimes it's closer to clinical applications, in particular when we have actual patient data. Still, what we are developing is not going to enter the clinic directly as a product.
So, Peter, you work in physics, or you have a background in physics. So I assume that machine learning and artificial intelligence is applied in these areas. This is where you're helping out. Yes. Are there any other areas?
No, I mean, we focus mostly on physics-related topics because this is our research field. In principle, we also see roughly a third of the projects is related to images or image-like data, because effectively also in physics, people use microscopes of one way or another. Also in the photon sciences or accelerator-based experiments, people use cameras to actually record images on a very, very small scale. However, the other third of projects that we actually seen arising over the couple of last years is anything related to making a bridge between experiment and simulation. Because especially physics has been very strong in coming up with simulations and theories to predict what should happen in an experiment. And therefore, a lot of machine learning is also used to bridge this gap, to either obtain, for example, theoretical parameters or simulation parameters in that particular case for a matching experimental observation. Apply statistics on steroids, if you want. And then the last third of projects is really a diverse set where we see an interplay between physics and other fields. So here it's really about anomaly detection, for example, is one of these applications where I really see that, but this also applies to image analysis, to be honest, where you really see that we can also profit from the experience and knowledge in Marie's team, and that we really can share different approaches and really exchange, okay, how did it work for your case? How does it work for my case? And this is really a nice thing about our network because it directly binds us together and really gives us a common forum where we regularly meet and can exchange all of these experiences.
As I'm sure you're aware of, there's been a lot of hype recently around machine learning and artificial intelligence. So are we going to be replaced? Are we going to have androids roaming the world doing Medicare? Do we even need doctors anymore in futures or physicists?
Question if doctors will be replaced and so on is in the air since at least 5 years, even maybe more. And this hasn't happened yet. And I think it is not the direction that it's taking currently, in particular in the clinic. Those systems are really coming as an aid and support for medical doctors, but not really going to replace, I think, like the doctors in the clinical practice. For us, I mean, I think it is definitely impacted, but it's positive. It certainly increases the dynamics of the field and people are more aware of the opportunities that AI offers. So I think they are more actively looking for help. They probably are more responsive, like attend to the events we organize and so on, to reach out to them more. So I think this is all in all very positive for us.
So in terms of the attention that it gets at the moment actually helps you in your work and, you know, people understand why there is a need, for instance, for AI consultants.
Yes. And I think also I have the impression in the different research centers, the hierarchy is probably also more receptive. Young researchers who want to try AI out gets a lot of freedom and so on. Mm. The dynamic, I think, is really good.
If I were a completely nasty journalist, then I would pick on one phrase that you used, Marie, which has said that it's currently not envisaged that we replace doctors with machine learning, which means that it kind of implies that in the future it might happen. How likely is that going to be?
I don't see it happening with the current models that we have. And ChatGPT and so on is not going to change the game for the medical applications. And I also personally don't believe that, you know, ChatGPT is a language model that is only through languages that you can encode the complexity, for example, of human physiology and have system that will actually replace doctors and doctors' thinking and encode the whole biology in there and understand the human body, let's say.
I would totally agree with Marie. What we've seen in the early 2023 is a tremendous improvement in innovation around this technology. So that's a given. Especially the open source community has been pushing industrial players and vice versa. So this is actually something that I think the whole field benefited from. However, what I really see is that, especially as Marie was talking about the current state of the models, and also from my personal singular experiments, they really struggle with causality to really let it out of the box. And this is something that is crucial, super crucial, not only in the clinic, but also in physics and science as a whole, right? This is what we are interested in, to find the causal reason why things happen and to infer from them and make predictions about the future. This is our main mandate. And I think for this core mission of science, I don't see the chance of large language model replacing us. However, I believe they will become an important tool to really interact, to also communicate and mediate knowledge. So I do teach a lot, and here I don't see large language models as a threat, but really as a positive game changer, because they can lend their hand as a learning companion, if you will. However, I totally buy into the footnote that Marie already made. The current model is maybe not too perfect. So maybe for knowledge that is super, super, super well established. But I mean, just ask ChatGPT to explain doing addition of two ratios. It just fails blindly. And these are the kind of small scale examples. I think they will be mitigated in the future. I think these assistants will get better. They will also be, as ChatGPT is already capable of also ingesting images or producing images potentially. So this will all change. And this is mostly a very challenging engineering task. But I think there are a lot of domains where they will play a major role as a tool. But really, that's, I think, where I believe our society will admit them. For more decisive roles where really decisions need to be made and inferences, also causal inferences, also statistical ones, need to be made and converted into knowledge and information, I don't see any inroads in there.
There's been one American cardiologist, Eric Topol, who wrote a book on AI in medicine, who highlighted the case that it is quite likely in the future an indispensable tool for helping doctors in their workflow and in their daily work, potentially as a triaging system, potentially if it's within a certain threshold, then it's either a diagnosis, it's a yes or a no. But then there's the wide area of cases where it will have to be referred to a consultant because it's not clear. In research where we are generating knowledge, how can AI and machine learning help there?
The main promise of AI is to, also for research, is to leverage the existing data sets to provide new and more precise or more complex insights that was previously done with, let's say, more classical machine learning methods. They could help to answer more complex research questions in the end. In my opinion, maybe from my point of view, this is most likely by bringing together different data modalities that were very difficult to bring together before. I see that in my field a lot, like omics and imaging and time series, and in particular in longitudinal data sets that are maybe not as structured as you would need for more traditional methods, for example.
Are we talking, for instance, we have a series of MRI scans and then we have some other data sets about blood pressure, as an example, or something else, and we're putting that all together and trying to make some sense out of it. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and potentially also the background and history of the patient, for example, which is also very difficult to integrate because it might be not as structured as you would like for traditional methods.
Yeah, I would complement this also from the physics perspective. I think the early days are coming to a close of machine learning in physics. I mean, physics, some domains of physics have a long tradition using machine learning. Particle physics is one example. There are surely others. Astrophysics is really on par, I would say. But really, it's about tackling complexity in an automated fashion. If experiments are well structured, which can be the case, but must not, even in physics, then it's really about making sense out of a large data set corpora, also from different sensors or different experiments and combining them. I think this is a big promise that machine learning can bring to the table. On one side, at least speaking experimentally, on the theory side, machine learning can actually help to automate and also to establish approximations that would be hard to get otherwise. So very often we see in theories that there are parameter settings where it's really tricky to compute something or it just takes forever.
Could you give an example?
Well, particle physics, for example, is a good thing. There are effectively new models beyond what we call the standard models, so beyond established knowledge, if you will, that really we need to scan. So we need to check, okay, what could this new particle be about? What mass could it have compared, for example, to the Higgs boson? And this is simply computationally expensive. You know, you just need to scan and compare all of these calculations to experimental observations. From these high precision simulations, we can make a step back and only sample these simulations where it really makes sense, and then train a neural network on this to actually help us interpolate. This is, of course, something that we need to be careful about, because also a neural network doesn't know everything and is limited in its capacity. So we really need to see how good is this approximation, how big are the uncertainties, and does actually bring such a neural network new aspects on the table, for example, where we can see, oh, here we are in a domain that is really uncovered territory. We should be careful here and really trust more in the simulation that is theory-based rather than a neural network. I just wanted to bring this up because it's a very promising avenue and really combines not only particle physics, but also cosmology and other domains in physics that really struggle from simply the compute resources that are available.
We have bioinformatics, we have medicine, we have the wide field of physics. Do you see any other scientific areas where AI and machine learning is being deployed and used?
In Helmholtz, we basically stretched this across other fields like Earth observation. This is the team in Hamburg that Marie alluded to earlier. So everything dealing with satellite images. Then we have the entire field of aerospace engineering. This is what TLR is. Here we have coming up with new airplanes, exploiting the data coming from airplanes, et cetera, or even space stations. And then we actually have the entire field of energy. So energy is a big topic, of course, for tackling climate change. But here the team in Karlsruhe at KIT is really looking at how to design networks of energy producers and consumers, for example, even how to simulate these kind of networks.
Machine learning and AI, as far as I understand, depends on the data that it's being built on. You have a test data set, then you have a training set, etc. When it comes to research where we don't know a lot of things about, often these training data sets or these test data sets can be quite small. And therefore, how reliable is the output of the machine learning model then? Is there a danger of overfitting or underfitting? And how do you deal with that in research in particular?
My research field, health, is probably the one where we have the smallest data sets compared to all others, because the data is there of more difficult to curate. I mean, there is little data. It is usually coming from actual patients. And then it's also the annotation of this data is very expensive. Then you have to be aware of those pitfalls, of course, overfitting and so on. And so use smaller models, properly test the algorithm, and then also clearly state limitations of your models when you publish them.
Are there any techniques that have evolved in recent years to deal with the shortcomings of smaller data sets?
It's a very broad field, first of all. There are standard techniques that you can do to ensure and check how sane is the model that you produced, how healthy it is. But I've also seen, especially in physics, there are now starting to come about neural networks that are also aware of the physics that are at play. So we're trying to build in these constraints, either building the neural network in the simulation or vice versa. Both of them have seen enormous growth, these fields. But there's also other techniques. So people are looking into combining, for example, image analysis models with geometric information that you, for example, know, I'm looking for 5 to 7 objects in the scene. So, well, this is something you can test. And there's other techniques that I'm particularly working on that actually takes into account symmetry information about the images. I think the community is really tackling these issues, both on making it possible to work with small data, but also to have more tools available to check the model that has been generated.
We talked about what AI and machine learning can be used for. We haven't talked about yet what it cannot or should not be used for. Are there any particular cases where you think, well, this isn't suitable for machine learning and AI, or you shouldn't really do it that way?
Yeah, I don't have one in mind, but the idea is that AI should not be used to develop anything that could harm humans in general. I mean, that's kind of the basic idea. But the problem is that the more fundamental the research on AI is, the more difficult this is to assess. But what we see, I think, is that conferences, like some renowned conferences like NeurIPS, for example, systematically ask for ethical statements. So they really encourage researchers to think about their algorithm, and in particular, this potential dual use of algorithms that, they could also be used for something more harmful than what you thought of at the beginning, which I think is a very good thing and should be taken very seriously by the community.
I totally believe that this is something that, again, machine learning has catalyzed, so that we really start to think more globally on these ethical considerations. But we also see that sometimes when you have a good simulation of something, there's no point. You know, if it's a cheap simulation and if it's good, why replace it? There's no reason to believe that neural networks are the one-size-all tool. I think there are good established tools available that also explain what they predict, which is something that machine learning models have a hard time doing, simply because they're probabilistic by nature. Also in this domain, we see quite some activity, at least the physicists that I talk to, and I'm sure Marie can account for similar stories. They immediately asked me this. What's the uncertainty of the prediction? Where did it come from? And because this is baked into our scientific DNA, if you will.
Going back to the medical use case and the fact that obviously AI shouldn't, or machine learning algorithms shouldn't harm patients at the minimum, they should benefit them, ideally. So do you see that we're moving into an area where we regulate the use of AI? Is that something that's come up in your work?
Not in my work, because we are really from the fundamental research side. And I'm also not a specialist, definitely, but I heard that there are different institutions, the FDA and the equivalent in Europe, are working on that. This is, of course, very difficult to find the right balance between regulating and not hindering any kind of innovation. But there are deep learning algorithms that have been certified, have been approved, and are already used, actually, in the clinic. As far as I understood, they have a very pragmatic approach, which is to extensively test them in the use case that it's intended for, and then, of course, clearly state the use case and the limitations and how the algorithm should be used. And that's for no very pragmatic, like you would do for any kind of drug. And I think this is kind of for no the pragmatic approach that is used.
Our role as consultants is also required in this, and relative to this question, is that especially clinics, so we are also working with the proton therapy institution here in Dresden together, is that these institutions also need to come up with their own data sets to test tools. So effectively, a CT is not a CT, right? It may be from the same manufacturer, but maybe there are different operator styles, different styles of protocols in each institution because it works for whatever reason. So for this reason, people and institutions need to think about representative test data sets by which they can also benchmark the progression. For example, if they use AI in their workflows to really see, they must have a standard candle for their particular kind of patients, for example. This is the discussions that we had here locally, basically in a round of people that use machine learning, either in physics or also in other domains. What I want to say with this is that the abundant use of machine learning also means that we need to be a little bit more careful and standardized with the data, and that we really need to set up these standard benchmarks or standard candles where we really can test the tools and the methods that we use in day-to-day practices.
Thank you. I would like to move on to how you work with other organizations. Now, clearly you are at Helmholtz and you have, you know, a lot of work there with consulting and helping researchers, but how can we envisage the collaboration with other institutions?
Our teams, the consultant teams, we are primarily dedicated to help researchers from the association. So mm-hmm. we are quite German focused, but we are also researchers. We travel, we go to conferences, we discuss with people, and then we have a lot of point-to-point collaborations with other research institutions.
The nice thing about machine learning is I always call it a horizontal tool, so you can use it in whatever domain you want. As long as the data is the same and the question that you ask the data is the same, you can actually use similar technology. And this provides us these inroads to other domains and also other networks. So in our case, we are collaborating very closely also with the local university landscape here in Saxony. We're also collaborating with international partners. So as Marie said, we also attend conferences and large networks, also more programming language focused networks like the SciPy or EuroSciPy conferences, but naturally also the machine learning big names. So this is the nice thing about our job. Even though we support other scientists, but we are also 100% scientists, we actually become a member of the partnering team for the time being of such a project that we use. And this is effectively our main mandate, to actually not only support, but also do science on our own.
So one question that I have is open science. In other discussions, we talked about reproducibility. So what does this mean in the context of machine learning and AI? How could we make work in AI and machine learning fair?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And looking at our network, I think we're starting to make the first steps. Really, as machine learning is still a very software-heavy field, so a lot of my team and also of other teams are very good software engineers, coders, and statisticians. This is where we start with reproducibility, namely the software. However, the data is becoming ever more important because garbage in, garbage out. So on the software side, we really need to start having the mindset. We as consultants, we start out with this mindset because we have to share our code, namely at minimum to the people that we support. So their reproducibility is really at heart. However, we must also acknowledge that right now and presently, the scales, if you will, to which extent you create a reproducible model, and that, as I said, includes the data, really differs. So it really differs to the field. Some fields are more bit-oriented, so they really want to ensure reproducibility down to the bit level, which is almost impossible. And other fields are really about sharing and understanding how the code works, how they can reproduce the code in their machine, et cetera, et cetera. And I think we're currently at this stage where all of these efforts start to get together, where people really can sit down and talk about it and share these expertises. Is it really only about documenting? Is it only about software environments, about Git, about, you know, I can name more technologies now? Or is it really about the mindset, how you approach a project, how you approach the research endeavor as a whole, and how it actually caters to the venues that you want to, for example, publish in? And so in this very diverse set of environments, and it's really multiple environments because it's at every level of the problem, we really also as a network have a unique opportunity to really now start walking together. And I have the feeling that in the network, there's a lot of agreement that this should be done. And we really will take in the next months, I think, decisive steps that we can also publish.
Thank you both so much for your time. Sounds like you're doing fascinating work, and I wish you all the best for the future.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for inviting us, and thanks for doing the podcast, Peter.
Oh, time's up. See you next time. But before I forget, this podcast is covered by the Creative Commons license. See ya.